Welcome to another AusChan Beijing podcast series. I'm here today with Ben Herskovitz, who's with China Policy, a Beijing-based policy analysis and strategic advisory firm. I'm here to talk about the recent Conference of the Parties in Paris. How are you going today, Ben?
Really well. Good to be with you.
Thank you. So firstly, for those who haven't been following the news out of Paris, what are the key outcomes from this COP conference?
So we've got an agreement, and it's been greeted with a lot of international fanfare, a lot of very positive, upbeat responses from world leaders. And in part, that enthusiasm is justified. This is a landmark agreement. It's a breakthrough, particularly after the debacle that was the Copenhagen negotiations in 2009. But the reason for the enthusiasm is that it was so hard to get an agreement previously, and this agreement is quite flexible. It's one that everyone could get on board with, and as a result of that, it could be argued that it's a somewhat weakened agreement. So it does have all the parties agreeing to undertake with a great deal of commitment to get global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, but it's one where each country is putting forward voluntary commitments to reduce carbon emissions and keep global warming within that 2 degree range. And it's also one where there is a significant amount of ambiguity / vagueness vis-a-vis the monitoring, reporting, and the verification of carbon emissions. So it's unclear precisely the kind of schedule that's going to be operating in that arena and how reliable those mechanisms are going to be. And then the final point I'm supposed to make is that it's an agreement where there's been broad-based global undertaking to keep global warming below the 2 degree range, but it hasn't actually been that ratified yet. So this is an agreement. Everyone has come and said, yes, this document, that reflects our views, but we still now have to go through the complex process of actually getting countries to sign up to the agreement via their own internal political processes. And then there's also a significant amount of political uncertainty as to how that plays out in key countries. So obviously, the world at the moment is captivated by what is a chaotic and wild US presidential campaign in the primaries. And if we have a President Trump in 2017, it's entirely unclear what would happen to COP21. And the Paris Agreement would presumably be the great, beautiful, shining document, but may in fact be torn apart in practice without the participation of the United States under Trump. Obviously, we're in the realm of hypotheticals here.
Yeah. So what, you mentioned the failure of Copenhagen. What would you say caused Paris to appear to have some form of success in comparison to Copenhagen before?
It's a really interesting question. I think part of it is that the Paris Agreement was, in a sense, a success and agreed upon before the negotiations actually started. So we had all of these really positive signals in the lead up to COP21. Things like the bilateral climate change agreement between China and the United States, or the bilateral climate change agreement between France and China. And those bilateral agreements are especially significant because, depending on who you talk to, the Copenhagen negotiations fell apart in large part as a result of the actions of China. China was seen as effectively the lead nation of a rebellion among developing nations against the proposals being put forward by the developed industrialized world. So we were already trending in a really positive direction just because of the optics in the lead up. But another key element, I think, which is not so often talked about, is the role of the global financial crisis in all of this. So in 2009 in Copenhagen, the prevailing focus of world leaders was on getting economic fundamentals right, avoiding recession, avoiding economic calamity, avoiding unemployment. And as a result of that, something like climate change, obviously considered to be a serious long-term problem by world's leaders, was not considered to be the immediate threat. Whereas Fast forward to 2015, and despite Judah's and inevitable economic uncertainties, we're in a much better place economically, and so there was perhaps more bandwidth among political leaders around the world to expend real political capital on something like a climate change agreement.
So you mentioned China being maybe one of the biggest stumbling blocks to the original, amongst others. What role do you foresee? Will there be their changed stance? What role do you foresee them playing in the future, the next 20 years, with the with climate change, but also green energy?
The role that China is likely to play, I think, is a very positive one in all of these arenas. And it speaks to two different rationales in Beijing for engaging internationally on the issue of climate change. One is Beijing's understanding, along with the understanding of other world capitals, that climate change is a real and very serious global threat. And China increasingly wants to be seen as a positive and proactive player globally when it comes to confronting serious international challenges. So in the security arena, for example, we're seeing China play a much more proactive role vis-a-vis a whole host of security challenges. In the Gulf of Aden, they're involved in anti-piracy operations. In South Sudan, they're providing a significant contingent of peacekeepers. And then in the economic arena, they're spearheading a whole host of financial institutions like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or the BRICS Development Bank. And being a proactive player in the arena of climate change and green energy is, I think, part and parcel of that broader Chinese push to be considered a responsible great power. And it ties in with a lot of the rhetoric we're seeing coming out of China at the moment. The catchphrase among the Chinese foreign policy elites is one of China's institutional voice, China wanting to be a key shaper of the global agenda, and as a result of that, assume greater global responsibilities for a whole host of global challenges, and climate change firmly fits into that category. And so China is wanting to stand up to the plate and say, yes, we are part of this process, we are responsible, we are providing global public goods. And then the second key reason, I think, for optimism when it comes to China's attitude to climate change and green technology is that Beijing understands that there is a really powerful domestic rationale for being proactive on green technology and climate change. And that is that pollution and environmental degradation more broadly is one of the key sleeper challenges, if you like, to the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. The Pew polling conducted in China again and again reveals that pollution is one of the primary concerns for your average Chinese person, one of the key causes of dissatisfaction, second only to corruption, typically. And it's generally in excess of something like 75% of respondents saying that pollution is a significant or major problem in China. So that means that for the Chinese Communist Party, there is a really strong reason for having green technology play a much larger role in the energy mix in China, simply for the sake of improving domestic air quality and reducing dissatisfaction with the ruling party and maintaining stability.
Okay, so if China was providing somewhat of a stumbling block, but they've developed to this point now, and you seem quite optimistic. How do other leading countries like America view, are they quite optimistic relating to China in this point of view? And then probably after that, well then how do we talk about what will India's role be? Because Modi seemed to have been providing a little bit of a, not a stumbling block, but somewhat of a, not as free-flowing as China in the latest Paris conference.
This is a great question. I think, generally speaking, the international view of China vis-a-vis climate change has undergone a dramatic evolution in the space of what is comparatively a small number of years. In 2009, as we were saying, China was viewed as the saboteur, effectively. And the Australian Prime Minister at the time had some very, very, very unflattering things to say about China, despite him being a great friend of China. Quite harsh insults, in fact. In 2015, the story is entirely different. China is welcomed and celebrated as a positive player in all of this. Now, it's true in saying that, that there is a greater level of skepticism in other parts of the developing world vis-a-vis COP21 and the undertakings of the industrialized world more broadly outside China. So in the lead up to COP21, there were significant calls by key developing countries for greater international finance from the developed industrialized world to assist with the movement towards less carbon intensive economies. And there was, again, significant criticism of the perceived inequity of the agreement being nutted out, in the sense that the industrialized world was seen as not doing enough given the historical legacy of all of its pollution. But here again, China has a relatively positive role to play, in that a big part of President Xi Jinping's grand foreign policy strategy, if you like, is providing massive amounts of investment to the developing world. The most famous example of this is the Belt and Road, which is this huge program of Chinese investments across Eurasia and Africa. But it extends beyond that as well. We have massive energy projects in Brazil. We have significant energy projects in the UK with the capacity cooperation between China and the United Kingdom government on a new nuclear power plant. And China can be a significant provider of the funds and expertise to assist not as wealthy developing nations like India more effectively respond to the requirements of COP21.
So coming out of the COP21 conference, many countries noted a year for when their peak carbon emissions would occur. And for China, that was in 2030. So what do you feel the likelihood of this occurring by 2030? And then at that point, if that so be, how do you see China's development being at that stage?
I suppose on this issue, again, we're entering the realm of the hypotheticals, and it's always dangerous to make predictions of this nature. But if I was to be a betting person, I would be inclined to bet on China actually being able to meet its goal of peak emissions by 2030. And I'd make that prediction based on some of the things we've already talked about. A, that China wants to be seen as a responsible player globally, and achieving that goal is part of that Chinese effort to be perceived as a responsible player. And then B, also achieving that goal is a nice handy way of also actually contributing to the stability of the Chinese regime and dealing with issues of chronic pollution and improving the perception of China domestically as well as internationally. But then there are a few other factors as well which make me relatively bullish and optimistic about this. One would be that the Chinese economy is obviously going through a massive transition at present, and we're seeing the rise of the services sector and the decline of investments in large-scale infrastructure projects. And that augurs well for China's attempt to transition to a lower carbon intensity economy. So in the latest round of data release on the Chinese economy, the key message in terms of the balance of the Chinese economy was that we've now reached a point where services make up 50% of the economy, and services are obviously less carbon intensive than other industries. And as China moves further towards a service oriented economy, we can expect that carbon intensity will moderate and Chinese economic growth won't necessarily be fueled by as significant production of carbon gases. And then another factor in all of this is that we're not going to see, in all likelihood, a China growing at 10, 11, 12, 15% in the coming years. It's going to be a much more moderate rate of growth. And that means that presumably we're not likely to see the kinds of incredibly swift upswings of carbon emissions in China. Certainly increasing in the short to medium term, but not at the rate previously. So despite all that positive gestures, there's still some uncertainty about the Chinese goal of peaking emissions by 2030. And I think a key aspect of that hinges on the monitoring, reporting, and verification process. So China has said that peak emissions by 2030 is its goal, but it still remains unclear how reliable China's monitoring, reporting, and verification is going to be on that issue. And so we may actually end up in a situation where that claim is made by China, but it's not entirely clear how accurate that claim is. So there's some ambiguity there. And then there's also, I think, the question of how that general national level goal plays out at provincial and local levels. So obviously there's a big difference between a national political leader pledging that they're going to achieve this big picture macro outcome in a number of decades versus all of the concrete decisions that need to be made by local officials, particularly when many of those concrete decisions would impact industries in their own areas adversely. So, for example, if you're a local official in a coal-producing part of China, you may see a pledge of that nature as being a disastrous outcome, and your vested interest might be in ensuring that that pledge doesn't actually become a reality. So there will be a significant amount of wrangling as China attempts to have this broad macro pledge hit the ground and result in changes at the lower levels of government.
I guess our listeners might be interested, how will this necessarily impact, how the outcomes of the Paris conference, how will the latest 13th five-year plan and the whole movement towards a cleaner China, how will these affect Australian but also foreign companies operating in China or have some interest with business relating to China?
Yeah, it's really hard to predict vis-a-vis COP21 because in so many ways, COP21 is, in the Chinese case, really indicative of the policy direction that China was already taking. So certainly in the very short term, we're unlikely to see a significant impact on Australian businesses or other international businesses because in many ways, what China pledged in COP21 is just a nice concise form of the existing policies. It's not a massive departure from what China was already doing. So for example, China is already a world leader when it comes to a whole host of green technologies, and China is, one would imagine, quite intent on maintaining its position of leadership in that arena. And so COP21 makes pledges vis-a-vis peak emissions and the use of green technology, but because China already enjoys a pretty commanding position in that arena, it's unlikely to result in a significant departure from current policies. And then I suppose the impacts of COP21 on certain key areas of Australian business that are exposed to the Chinese economy may be mitigated somewhat by other government plans in train in China. So presumably the first thought when you think of COP21 and impacts on Australian businesses would be the Australian mining and resources sector, iron ore that goes into making steel and coking coal that goes into that process and all of the huge carbon emissions associated with that. And on the face of it, that's right. It presumably is a significant challenge to that industry. But there are really good signs in this arena, which may be at odds with the goals of COP21, but I suppose that's a question for another day. And that is that we still have this massive expectation for extensive urbanization in China in the years ahead. So currently the urbanization rate in China is sitting at something like 54-ish%. And the goal is by 2020, which is just a few years away, to get it up to something like 60%, which is a huge upswing in urbanization. And that requires a huge amount of coke and coal and a huge amount of iron ore, which is good news for Australian companies. And then more broadly, going forward from that, the urbanization rate of advanced industrialized economies is usually something like 70 to 80%, depending on the country you're talking about. And so clearly, if China is heading in that general trajectory, you'd expect huge amounts of urbanization in the coming decades. And that means that the potential downside of COP21 for, say, for example, the Australian mining industry may well be in part offset by broader urbanization plans in China.
So what, just I guess finishing up, when we've had Copenhagen, now we just recently had Paris, what's in the future, what's the next mark that we shall see the progress of China and the world community going towards our goal of keeping under the 2-degree mark that you've mentioned before?
So getting COP21 was an incredible achievement and a great challenge, getting the agreement out of COP21. And the world has gotten that far. And I think world leaders are probably exhausted and are pretty amazed that they got to that point in any case. So I wouldn't expect any significant movement in this arena in terms of big multilateral agreements in the coming decades. My suspicion is that the key things that we're going to see, hopefully, in the coming years would be the widespread ratification of the Paris Agreement that came out of COP21. And that in and of itself is going to be a massive challenge. And there'll be a huge amount of wrangling associated with that, especially in a country like the United States post-presidential election. And then more broadly, I would expect that there'll be renewed effort to ensure that the monitoring, reporting, and verification system associated with the Paris Agreement is actually effective, and that the data is reliable, and that countries are living up to the commitments they made as part of COP21, even though those commitments were voluntary. And that, again, will probably result in a significant amount of wrangling and back and forth and contestation as governments try and fudge the figures or claim that they've met their commitments when they may have not in fact done that. So we've got an agreement in place which is significant, it's a milestone, but in many respects the politics has only just begun.
Cool. So who's your vote, Trump or Clinton?
No comment.
Thanks for your time today, Ben.
Thank you. Great to be with you.